Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
Very happy today. We're going to be talking to Stephen Gowans, and the timing of the show couldn't be better. The United States, after its own fashion, has elected a president for Canada. And there's a lot of cheering going on in the mainstream media in Canada and the United States, of course, about what a dramatic change this is going to be. And Stephen Gowans has an October 25 article in What's Left. You can find What's Left on the internet at gowans.blog. It has the title, The Chinese Uyghur Dark Legend and Washington's Campaign to Counter Chinese Economic Rivalry. The first sentence reads, U.S. presidential candidate and former Vice President Joe Biden has referred to the U.S. empire as the international system that the United States so carefully constructed. The late Italian philosopher Domenico Lucerto called Biden's international system an international dictatorship of the United States. Well, Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phil. Hello.
Your article couldn't be better timed because you do open with paragraphs about the U.S. system of which Biden has inherited the leadership. And we did say on the show last week, and we've often commented on this, that whoever is president of the United States is also the president of all the countries that the U.S. dominates. And this has become really ugly in the case of Meng Wanzhou. We may talk about that today, I don't know, but I don't have the impression that it is regarded that way in our media. I think probably the Canadian people feel that way. But talk about Joe Biden and what difference he's going to make in the life of the ordinary Canadian or Chinese or the people of Africa or South America.
What difference is he going to make? No difference. No difference. I was kind of anticipating that you might ask me something about Biden and whether the Biden presidency means any kind of profound or even mild change. And I think the answer to that is no. I think you can say that definitively. And maybe the reason or the way to think about this is to think about Biden or Trump or Obama or any other U.S. president as the CEO of the corporation. And you have successions of CEOs. Does that mean that the corporation's direction changes? I mean, not in any kind of profound sense. I mean, the corporation continues to try to generate as much profits as possible, continues to treat its employees in exactly, well, not exactly the same way, but perhaps with mild differences here and there. But the goals always remain the same. And I think the goals, not that I think, I know that the goals being pursued by US presidents remain fixed from one presidency to the next. There may be different ways of achieving those goals, but the goals kind of define or create a framework within which policy is developed, whether it's domestic policy or foreign policy. So we shouldn't expect to see much difference at all. Mm-hmm. I might cite, I like the analysis of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, who's asked this repeatedly when he's interviewed, which is, well, do you care whether you have a Trump presidency or a Biden presidency? And his answer is very similar to the one that I've just provided. What he said, when this was last asked him, we usually don't expect presidents in the American elections, we expect, and he used the same words as I did, CEOs. But he went on to say, you have a board, and the board is made up of the lobbies and the big corporations like banks and the armament companies and the oil companies. So what you have is the CEO, and the CEO doesn't have the right or the authority to review. The CEO has to implement that policy or the objectives, the strategy. And then he goes on to argue that's what happened with Trump as well, that although Trump talked about pursuing different policy than perhaps the Democrats had, in the end, if you look at it, the policies we were pursuing were not markedly different. They may be a bit different on the surface. You may have created the appearance that there was a difference, but they were largely the same.
Mm-hmm. It's striking, isn't it? I notice in the nuance and the commentary that they're basically, in terms of selling Biden as the leader, making it that Biden is probably makes it easier for the other members of the board to function because Trump had bad manners, mm-hmm. right? Much of the commentary, basically, they're against him because he's a lout. Mm-hmm. People suspect that's why he enjoys a certain amount of support in the population, because they seem to understand his language better than they do people like Obama or the guys who went to Harvard. The Harvard guys talk in a way that's very offensive to the ordinary ear, I think. But in terms of policy, I noticed that Netanyahu immediately reminded everybody that he and Biden are very, very good mm-hmm. friends. So I haven't heard anybody ask, is Biden going to withdraw the U.S. embassy from Jerusalem? Is he going to tell Israel to leave the West Bank, where they built, a Trump statue or something there put up? What do you know about that?
Well, that seems very unlikely that he would reverse these Trump policies. There's something I read that was very interesting this morning in a publication, an online publication called Responsible Statecraft. And this author in this particular publication was taking up this question about whether we could expect Biden's foreign policy to differ from that of Trump in the Middle East, especially with respect to Israel and Iran. And his argument was, no, this isn't the case, because what drives that foreign policy? It's not, people assembling in the State Department and saying, what's good for the people of the United States? What's driving the foreign policy are the political goals of very wealthy individuals who have extraordinary influence on the US government and the state. And they have extraordinary influence in various ways by establishing foundations through their influence on the Council for Foreign Relations, for example. And this author pointed particularly to Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate, and also the head of, or the guy who founded Home Depot, both of whom are investing millions and millions of dollars, not only in backing certain politicians who have certain points of view about Israel and how the United States should advance the interests of Israelis, but also in establishing foundations and various think tanks and experts who pressure not only the media to provide certain points of view, but also the U.S. State Department. And those people, what Assad called the board of directors, don't go away. Their goals and their objectives don't go away simply because we have a new president or a new individual filling that the role.
Incidentally, we should point out along the line that get your thoughts about this, but one of the curiosities of this election is that the United States Congress didn't move. It stayed basically slightly under the control of the Democratic Party with a loss of some seats. The United States Senate remains under the control of the Republican Party, and within those entities there, it's pretty balanced, fairly balanced. But all of them agree on the project that you're talking about of US leadership and hostility to Syria, hostility to Iran, bans on now on Lebanon, which are becoming very dangerous, and policy towards China. Am I right?
No, absolutely. And cited the words of Biden that I quoted at the beginning of my article. And what struck me about those words, for example, he talked of the international system that the United States so carefully constructed, was that you could read Republicans and, you know, high profile Republicans who say exactly the same thing, use exactly the same language. This idea that America must lead. And if you interrogate that, what does that mean? America must lead. Well, it means every other country must follow willy-nilly. Every other country must submit. And the idea that America must lead is the idea that America must be a despotic country, that it enslaves others. And that might seem extreme to say enslave, but when you say we must lead and else must submit, essentially that every other country exists for the benefit of the United States and the people who matter in the United States, which is the president of directors, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. Biden had said in this article, which was an article in Foreign Affairs is considered the unofficial or informal journal of the U.S. State Department, that once he assumed the presidency, he would take immediate steps to have, quote, America lead the world. And it's interesting to look at what he means by that, or what they mean when they say we're going to lead the world. And he made it pretty plain, because he said more than 95% of the world's population lives beyond our borders, and we want to tap those markets. That's how he wants to lead the world, essentially. And he went on to say, how am I going to lead the world? I'm going to take down trade barriers. I'm going to resist foreign protectionism. I'm going to ensure that the United States writes the rules that govern trade. Well, it's not only Democrats that say that. Republicans say exactly the same thing. There's no departure here at all from any kind of U.S. foreign policy. The United States has been pursuing this policy for decades and decades and decades. But you can ask the question, what if part of the 95% of the world's population that lives beyond U.S. borders, which has markets that Biden says the United States is going to tap, what if they don't care to share their markets with U.S. investors and corporations? Are they to be granted the sovereignty to organize their economic and political lives as they see fit, as we would expect in any kind of democratic arrangement? Or is it the case that America must lead and they must submit to American dictates, and that the Americans are going to write the rules that govern trade and are going to smash down their, you know, their trade barriers? And if you look at this in greater detail, what it is that Biden is proposing and what it is that others have proposed, either previous Democratic presidents or previous Republican presidents, is that their economic playing field must be global, that no country can opt out, and that the playing field must allow U.S. businesses to win. And when they say this is the international system that the United States has created and profited from and become prosperous as a result of, that's what they mean.
Yeah. When they say built, they mean rigged.
Rigged, yes. And then China, however, challenges this. And this irritates people like Biden, because it irritates the board. Biden says, you know, if China has its way, it will continue to use subsidies to get its state-owned enterprises a leg up, and it could end up dominating the technologies and industries of the future. That's something that alarms the U.S. government. it can't be the case that China or any other country dominates the technologies and industries of the future. That must be the exclusive domain of the United States. And there's this great acme of hypocrisy here, because Biden and others and the board, they all complain bitterly about these so-called subsidies that China gives to its state-owned enterprises, suggesting that China is competing unfairly. And yet, U.S. businesses are awash on a sea of subsidies. Even Biden, in the course of the election campaign, was talking about all the subsidies he was going to be providing to U.S. Corporations, right from a Buy American campaign to a campaign to provide U.S. businesses with, you know, funding so that they can compete in strategic high-tech sectors, and he named them, you know, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, 5G, all of the things that China says it wants to dominate. Well, the United States is going to dominate too, or at least that's the objective. And the objective is to use public funds to subsidize private U.S. business in this rivalry with China, while at the same time complaining about Chinese subsidies.
We're speaking to Stephen Gowans. Stephen, his last book was The Long War, Washington's Long War on Syria. Stephen, also, the enthusiasm for Biden involved actually people covering their ears and not listening to him. He did say, you quoted in your article, in What's Left, buy American. That's a Trumpism, one would think, but if you look at him, listen to him, he isn't kidding. That is his point of view. And we're talking about Biden.
Yeah, it's America first, buy American. America will lead the world. But what I found really interesting, though, in his article in Foreign Affairs, in which he talked about, complained about Chinese economic rivalry. What was fascinating is he said, you know, that we need to confront China. We need to deal with them as an economic rival. And how should we deal with them as an economic rival? By confronting them over human rights.
Bingo.
By building a united front of US allies and partners to confront. That's the way you're going to address economic rivalry.
Our values and rule of law, I think, is the way Chrystia Freeland states it. So our values, talk about our values in relation to the free world.
Yeah, well, they're going to confront China over alleged human rights violations and abuse of its Muslim population. That's the plan. And present the United States as if it is a champion of human rights. Well, the United States is not a champion of human rights, except if you want to talk about the human rights of the board that determines what it is that Biden and Trump do. And this is the acme of hypocrisy to suggest that the United States should be leading some kind of campaign for human rights. When we look at the kinds of allies the United States has, for example, one of its great allies in the Middle East is Mohammed bin Zayed, who is the effective ruler of the United Arab Emirates. Now, he obediently does what foreign rulers are supposed to do under the international system that the United States has so carefully constructed, which is promote U.S. economic and strategic interests. But he is hardly, if you want to talk about human rights violations, human rights problems, and abuse of local populations, then the first person you should be talking about is Mohammed bin Zayed, or MBZ, as they call him. First of all, the United Arab Emirates has no democracy whatever, and MBZ is quite openly hostile to the notion of suffrage. He says that the Emiratis are backward. They don't have the education you can't have a democracy in this part of the world, that he must rule, he must have his despotic rule. And the United States is very comfortable with that. He's one of their great allies. In fact, in Washington, it said that if you want anything done, that's the guy to go to, MBZ. So he buys lots of, you know, lots of armaments from the US military industrial complex. He does what the CIA and the Pentagon ask him to do. His economy is integrated into the US economy. If you look at the Wall Street Journal Index of Freedom, which is kind of an index of the extent to which economies are accommodating of US foreign investment and exports, well, he's, or the United Arab Emirates is regarded as the most free or the most accommodating in West Asia or in the Arab world. So he's that's the kind of allies the United States has.
A pure hypocrisy.
Pardon me? And
I said a pure hypocrisy, as you said. This is Stephen Gowans. The blog site is What's Left. It's easy to find Stephen Gowans. He's also the author of Washington's Long War on Syria, very pertinent to the discussion today. We now have what you call the dark legend with Secretary of State Pompeo and whoever Biden's Secretary of State is going to be, taking up the cause of what they call oppressed Muslims in China, the Uyghur. And in your article, you point out there's a few countries with whom the United States has allied, Egypt and India and others, who have a pretty nasty record, but there's no discussion of whether or not there's any genocide, some evil practice in those countries. But talk about this dark legend. What, you know, by the way, it came out of the blue. I don't, 5 years ago, we weren't discussing. Suddenly we have this immense problem, which is, it seems to be created out of whole cloth somewhat.
Yeah, the problem of the Uyghurs. And you pointed to Egypt, you pointed to other countries, and I just talked about the United Arab Emirates, but I shouldn't even be talking about that. We can talk about the United States itself and its record with Muslims, and in particular with jihadists. I mean, if we look at the US record, it's astonishing we even have to point this out, or that anyone could ever say, how can the United States claim to be a champion of human rights for Muslims when we consider, for example, the US invasions of Muslim countries, war on Iraq, war on Afghanistan, war on Syria, or we think about Abu Ghraib, you know, the prison in occupied Iraq in which US military and CIA personnel did things like abuse prisoners, they tortured them, they beat them, they engaged in sexual assault, rape, indecencies against dead bodies, murder, Guantanamo Bay. The list just goes on and on. I mean, we had US General Barry McCaffrey who admitted that, quote, we tortured people unmercifully. We probably murdered dozens of them during the course of the so-called war on terror. In fact, 100 prisoners or more were tortured to death by US personnel. And how was this excused? It was excused by former US President Barack Obama as, well, we tortured some folks. So, you know, Obama, the winner of the Nobel.
Some folks, I recall. Yes. Yes.
And so the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize said, well, we're not going to torture folks anymore. Instead, I'm going to have an assassination program, which is the drone strike program. So he uses his unaccountable army, the CIA, to assassinate Islamist militants. And the U.S.
And by the way, isn't there a distinction between their militants or that was, say, a freedom fighter is someone in Syria, and then, but At the same time, the U.S. is sponsoring people who are terrorists. And I guess it's very, it'd be very apropos. I should have raised at the beginning. The United States has just decided to take the Turkestan
Islamic movement
is now off the terror list.
Yes.
These are the elements that China has had a problem with, and they are indeed terrorists. They are allied with Al-Qaeda. They are fighting apparently now in Azerbaijan alongside Azerbaijani forces. They fight inside Syria. They came there via Turkey. There's no question about who they are, but the U.S. is basically unleashing them to kill Chinese citizens. Am I right?
Yeah. So, I mean, you pointed out, I mean, there's this phenomenon of, we call it violent jihadism. Let's just, for short, we'll call it that. And it's present in many places of the world. I mean, it's present in Europe. We've seen it in France recently, present in Syria. And yeah, you're right. The United States has encouraged this, this tendency to achieve its own political aims. It did that infamously in Afghanistan. It's done that in Syria. And also it has suffered at the hands of Islamic jihadists. And when it does, well, the way in which it depicts those jihadists and the response to them is very different from when those Islamic jihadists attack official enemies like Syria. If they attack Syria, then the response is regarded as, you know, the illegitimate war on by a brutal dictator on his own people. So likewise, we're using the same characterization of what's going on in China. In China, you have this long tradition of secessionist violence that's carried out under either this pan-Turkic or pan-Islamic banner. And the Chinese government has been trying to deal with it in a way that is more humane and certainly less violent than the United States has dealt with the same phenomenon. I mean, how does the United States deal with this phenomenon when it's aimed at the United States with massive violence, with war, with invasions, with torture, with imprisoning people in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo Bay? How has China dealt with its problem of violent jihadism? Well, it's dealt with it in two ways. In a way that the United States might have called, if they weren't interested in creating this dark legend about China, they might have called it winning hearts and minds, which is providing economic development, providing jobs, providing job training, and providing re-education, or what may be called de-radicalization. And these de-radicalization programs, re-education is done throughout West Asia by U.S. by U.S. Allies such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and so on. There's an attempt to re-educate those people who are inclined to use violence to achieve political ends, violence especially against civilians. The Chinese have done exactly the same thing. But in order to create this dark legend, to make it seem as if the Chinese are trying to eradicate Islam in China, there's this dark legend about concentration camps and the Chinese rounding up Muslims and throwing them into Chinese camps or into concentration camps, which is supposed to evoke imagery of the Nazis rounding up Jews and placing them in concentration camps.
Yes. And by the way, Stephen, speaking to Stephen Gowan, you often make the point, and it should be underlined, I believe, regularly, that we're talking about different social systems. The Chinese approach to this issue is economic, it's materialist, it doesn't engage in the spiritual or the or public relations approach to solving a problem. They say these at root, they believe it's a class issue. It is poverty. They point out that Western China, of course, has not been able to develop as fast as Eastern China with the coastal ports and cities. And they say they've got to transfer wealth and they have to invest. I mean, it's refreshingly frank and open to talk about the problem in that way. And they've enjoyed success. Isn't it true that the United States actually hasn't been able to get together a group of countries to attack China on this point? Most of the countries in the region say they agree with China. I noticed that in Indonesia recently, when they were getting a visit from Pompeo, deported three Uyghur to China just as a kind of a little message to Pompeo. They're not unhappy with China's dealing with this issue.
Oh, China has been praised by Muslim majority countries for the way in which it deals or treats its Muslim population. Those countries that have been condemning China are countries that do not have large Muslim populations and who are, you know, the satrapies, part of the US empire, the usual suspects like Canada, for example. But even the Muslim allies of the United States in West Asia are not criticizing China for the way in which it deals with its Muslim population, because China is dealing with that population in much the same way those countries try to deal with violent jihadists, which I said is through re-education rather than the American approach, which is extermination through drone strikes or throwing people.
Job creation in which is Egypt and others, and certainly the United States, they really aren't very good at creating
no
job. They say you're unemployed, you're miserable, and you seem to have a lot of jihadists. We think we ought to kill the jihadists. You know, like that's not the Chinese way of doing it. By the way, could you remark on how clumsy I find it at any rate? The U.S. propaganda is they rely on somebody named Zenz to write all their major documents. The Globe and Mail quotes Mr. Zenz with a straight face. Who the heck is Zenz?
Yes, Adrian Zenz. He is a researcher at something called the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. And you look at the center of all of these attacks against China, these attempts to create the Black Legend, or all of these foundations and what appear to be grassroots groups, but are not grassroots at all. I think you call them AstroTurf, which is they're supposed to appear to be grassroots, but behind them, you'll find the US government or very wealthy individuals or both. So the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation is a US government established foundation whose mission is to discredit communist governments, whether of the past or current, which is the most salient of the current communist governments, China. And they believe that communist regimes commit the worst human rights abuses in the world today. That's where they begin. So that's the founding assumption, and then they operate to try and gather data which seems to corroborate that view. Zenz, who's regarded as an expert on the Uyghur, is a far-right fundamentalist Christian who opposes homosexuality. He opposes the equality of the sexes. He supports corporal punishment of children. And he believes he's been given a mission by a supernatural being to destroy the People's Republic of China, which he sees as an abomination against fundamentalist Christianity. So he's something like a Christian version of Osama bin Laden.
And is the Globe's favorite expert on the Uyghur?
Well, the Globe, he's appeared before the US Congress, before the Canadian Parliament. He's sought out by the New York Times. He's interviewed on Democracy Now. He's the go-to person. And no one ever asks what's behind, you know, the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. what's behind this? Who is this Adrian Zen?
Well, we've been speaking with Stephen Gowans. The last portion here, Stephen, I think it's people should know about your writing, that you always emphasize in your writing why the U.S. has targeted countries like Syria, Cuba, China, Iran, and it comes down to a clash of systems. And so could you, and I guess I'll ask you to focus a bit on that issue, because as when Joe Biden left office, the Secretary of State was Hillary Clinton, and she was playing with a very dangerous idea of a no-fly zone in Syria, which everybody could see would be one of those little moments which might actually be a flashpoint to major war. The United States under Trump has troops in Northeast Syria, and you have the title Long War on Syria. So what do you suppose Mr. Biden and company are gonna be doing in Syria, and why do they do that? Why are they determined to get Syria?
Well, you know, this kind of underlines the continuity in US foreign policy, because you talked about the no-fly zone. And I said that Trump pursued the same policy, just didn't describe it in always the same way. There is a no-fly zone in Syria. It's the no-fly zone over the US occupation zone, which comprises one third of Syria, that part of the country that has the country's oil wells and the best farmland. There is a de facto no-fly zone because the United States has air superiority over that region. It dominates that region. No one moves into it. And it is US air supremacy, which is the foundation of the US occupation of that part of Syria. So it's interesting that nothing really changed under Trump with respect to Syria versus what had been going on under Obama. I mean, Trump talked a lot about, we're taking the troops out. Well, that never happened. The troops remained there. There were contractors, what's called contractors, which are actually a whole lot of mercenaries that the United States has been using in Syria. It has its so-called...
Can I just ask you, Stephen, isn't that a subsidized military operation? In other words, all those guys are former U.S. military, or the bosses.
Yes.
So in other words, they were trained by the United States at the expense of U.S. government. Now they make millions of dollars calling themselves contractors. So basically, they're mercenaries and pirates.
They are, exactly.
18th century.
Exactly that. And they're in Syria, and they're there to deny the Syrians access to their oil and access to their best farmland so that they will not have the revenue to reconstruct their country. And if they can't reconstruct their country, they hope, and in fact, James Jeffrey, the special representative to Syria, has said this, we believe the government's going to collapse. And that's our intention, is to drive that government into oblivion so that we can replace it. We can replace a government that apparently is acceptable to the Syrian people with one that is acceptable to the board that governs U.S. politics. So that is, you know, corporate USA. But, you know, one point I want to make with respect to China, there was something very interesting I read this morning. It was in Press TV, but it was citing something that was said on Sky TV. And this was Britain's chief of defense staff, General Nick Carter. And he said, I think we are living at a moment in time where the dynamic of global competition is a feature of our lives. And I think the real risk we have is you could see escalation lead to miscalculation. And then he was asked whether his words meant there was a genuine threat of another world war. And he said, I'm saying it's a risk and we need to be conscious of those risks. And I would add to that, that last month, Trump said he wanted to bring home troops from Afghanistan to be ready to fight China. So, you know, when we talk about this, this human or confronting China over its alleged human rights abuses. I mean, it's not the case that the United States is preparing to wage war against China because it believes China is a malign force in the world. Instead, it's the case that the United States must present China as a malign force in the world in order to mobilize public support for a war against China. And a war whose roots lay in the desire of US businesses to dominate these lucrative profit-making opportunities and industries of tomorrow.
Yeah, that's sobering. As I noticed that Biden's most recent words were, we're going to isolate and punish China.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we may see a few words from other powers saying, does that include us? The price is going up. Stephen Gowan, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Wonderful article, the Dark Legend, what's left, and of course your book, Washington's Long War on Syria. Thank you very much for writing all that, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, no, bye-bye. This is CIUT 89.5 FM, The Taylor Report, and we'll be back in just a moment.